Governor's Bill, Senator Roebling, Senate File 575. And today we're going to be talking about the family residency programs. We have representatives here from the different programs. And then we're going to look at Article 1, 2, and 6. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you mentioned, we're starting off with the family practice residency programs. And our first guest today to explain their program and their request is they're from the Mayo Clinic. And it's Barbara Porter, Assistant Dean for Academic and Student Affairs, and Dr. Stephen Adamson. And they have a slide presentation, and we'll let them get started with it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I don't think we've ever had you come in before, and so this is new for us. I look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, and thank you, Senator Roebling. We'll run through a quick presentation and share with you just an overview of the Mayo Medical School and the Mayo Clinic Family Medicine Residency Program and how we utilize the appropriation that you provide us. Initially, just wanted to frame this by sharing with you one of the core principles of Mayo Clinic, where our programs are located, and that is to educate physicians, scientists, and allied health professionals to be a dependable source of health information for our patients and the public. And that component of education is what we'll address with our presentation. Just a quick overview for you. I'm with the medical school, and our medical school is part of a continuum of education to provide physicians for the state of Minnesota. Just again, the overview that we share with you shows you the duration of training that is required to take a student through the undergraduate component through to where they either practice as primary care physicians or as subspecialists. So a total of 11 to 20 years, just to frame the discussion. Our education enterprise at Mayo is very large. Dr. Adamson and I will be talking with you about two components of what is actually a five-school program. I'm situated in the Mayo Medical School, which started in 1972, so we're in our 35th year. Dr. Adamson is with our graduate medical education program, or our residency program. A quick overview again of the history of our school. Just you all may realize that the school was started as a result of a physician shortage in the state during the latter part of the 60s and 70s. And we were encouraged by the state. Mayo Clinic was encouraged to establish a medical school to help mitigate this shortage. The institution labored long and hard with the decision, but because there were certainly some factors that needed to be taken into consideration, most notably the enormous cost of educating medical students. And to field a medical school is not an insignificant kind of venture. We were concerned that we not drain the resources that are dedicated to our primary mission, which is, of course, patient care. The University of Minnesota Duluth and Mayo Medical School at the same time in the early 70s, though, were established, and we continue to operate. As I mentioned, we're in our 35th year. Today, the mission of the school remains the same as it was when we started, and that's to train leaders in what we refer to as academic medicine, not only the practice of medical practice, but also education and research. Our school has turned into one of the most competitive in the country. We're small, with only 42 students per year, or a total of 168 in our student body. We're very proud of the fact that 46% of our graduates do enter practice right here in the state of Minnesota, and on average, about 40% of those students enter primary care areas.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
If I might ask a question while we're on that point. Mm-hmm. Do you know what percentage of the student body is from Minnesota?
Every year it varies. We were just talking about that. Currently, I would say of the 34 MD-only students, about six, on average, about six of those students are from the state of Minnesota. Initially, the school was open with a much larger percentage of students. Again, we continue to be a very innovative medical school, very patient-focused, as is our practice. Our students are trained in a model that focuses on the patients. Today, we do attract a national student body with students coming coast to coast. So we perceive that we are a net importer of physicians to the state, because that small percentage that enter today, many of our students from out of state do end up practicing, and we'll share some numbers with you about that, practicing here in Minnesota. They're excellent students and become excellent physicians, as is Dr. Adamson here, who's a graduate of Mayo Medical School. We graduate all of our students, and shame on us if we didn't. We're only 42 per class. They perform in a superb manner on all the outcome measures that are used to track medical students and physicians. One of the hallmarks of our school is diversity, and this is an important issue for us at Mayo and within the state as we continue to try and field a student body and graduates who come from areas that have typically been underrepresented in medicine so that they can go back to those areas and practice. And that includes rural physicians and students from ethnic and racial backgrounds that are traditionally underrepresented in medicine. We lead, for private medical schools, I would say we're certainly in the top one or two in the country in terms of overall percentage of students from those groups. Both our school and our students are extremely committed to serving the underserved, and today we are in partnership with the university on a pipeline program to provide students what's called a future doctors program to provide students of color for the state of Minnesota. So we're very proud of that. 55% of our graduates are from Minnesota, and that is because initially we had a large base of students from Minnesota. So our alumni pool is only about 1,200 plus, with only 35 years of history and 31 years of graduates. So about over half still are in total from the state of Minnesota. And of that number, 46% have remained here in Minnesota to practice medicine. 5-year rolling average for students in terms of career choices, 40% are choosing primary care fields, and Dr. Adamson will talk more with you about what that means. Our appropriation that we receive from the state of Minnesota helps us to defray the cost of educating each medical student, which is significant. It's almost $70,000 per year per student, so the appropriation is very helpful to us. And I'll turn the microphone over to Dr. Adamson to talk to you about the next phase in the continuum, and that being residency training and specifically family medicine.
Thank you very much, Dean Porter. Dr. Adamson.
Thank you. I'm the chair of the family medicine department at Mayo, but I'm here representing the residency, and I'll talk to you a little bit about what that involves. For those that don't know what residency is, part of the training is the intern year. You've probably heard about interns, maybe not always in a favorable manner. That's not to be confused with internist, which is somebody who's completed a residency. So our program is a 3-year program. A little bit about the Mayo School of Graduate Medical Education. There are 1,400 residents and fellows. So Rochester is a little bit of a unique town that way with the number of physicians that we have in town. There's probably 2,500 in total, something like that. There are 230 programs at Mayo Rochester. Many are among the most competitive in the country for the residency and fellowship slots. It's one of the largest residency programs in total in the Midwest, with 1,100 residents only in Rochester. The other 300 residents and fellows, those are subspecialty fellows, just to be clear on that. 22,000 alumni since 1915. Our residency program, there are 24 residents in a 3-year program, so 8 per year. The residents serve a rural service area of about 18,000. The outpatient facility is based in Casson, Minnesota, which is a town of around 2,500 people. There are 135,000 patient visits in family medicine in our department. We actually have 6 different sites, including 3 within the city limits of Rochester, the one site at Casson. We also have a small site in Kenyon, Minnesota, and also have a site at the Prairie Island Indian Reservations, up in Red Wing, Minnesota. Actually, Welch, I think, is the official town. Of the 135,000 visits, 35,000 visits actually occur at Casson, which is where the training program is based for the outpatient part of it. Our residency training program, I think, creates excellent physicians, but because of our rural nature for the outpatient facility, we provide unique training for rural practice and also medically underserved patient populations. The funding that we're looking for helps to support the resident stipends for our primary care or family physician residents. there's not a lot of money in family medicine and primary care, so that's why we need the funding. Some of the things that our residents are involved in, if I can talk about that briefly, there's a free clinic in Dodge Center mainly for teenage women with pregnancy-related issues and birth control-related issues. They also do rotate to the Prairie Island clinic. It's the Dakota Tribe at Prairie Island. Worksite visits to local employers. McNeilis has been one of those, but there are several others. In-home visits for homebound. We do make house calls. In fact, I'm one of the teachers for the house call things for the residents. So contrary to popular opinion, we still do that. In fact, Mac, I bet you probably do still as well. We support five rural nursing homes in the area, some around the Cass and Dodge Center area, then also one in Hayfield, also one in Kenyon. We also provide sideline athletic coverage at the rural schools in the area as well. Some other things that are interesting, the residents write biweekly articles for the Dodge County Independent. That's not a real large circulation newspaper, as you might have gathered. They're also involved in the MOST program, which is Health Talks to Local Schools. And I'm sorry, I don't remember what the MOST acronym stands for. I apologize. Also the NEST program, and this is affiliated with the free clinic in Dodge Center, again, for teenage women. Our program has been very successful. We've had all of our positions filled for the last 25 years. This is something a little unique for family medicine. The number of physicians choosing that career track has actually decreased. Mayo Medical School does quite well. I think we've got six or seven or maybe even eight residents this year out of the class who are going to family medicine. But nationally, that has not been the case. We've, on the other hand, have done quite well. 54% of our graduates are practicing in Minnesota. We're a net importer of rural family physicians to Minnesota. So, you know, less than half of the residents come from Minnesota, but over half actually stay in Minnesota. Since 2000, 9 of the 29 graduates are practicing in rural Minnesota, and we're defining that as a community of less than 10,000. This is a pin map that shows where everybody is at. We're missing two pins. We have somebody that's practicing in Eveleth, Minnesota, and also in Duluth, Minnesota as well. I guess Duluth wouldn't be rural, but we do have some physicians up in the northeastern part of the state. Medical education is one of Mayo's three shields. It's education, practice, and research. We always seem to think that the practice wheel is the biggest on the tricycle, but the education is a huge operation at Mayo Clinic. Without outside funding, we cannot continue the programs that we do, and we have to cut things. So we certainly appreciate the opportunity to come up here and talk about that. I think the state, with the initial platform to get Mayo Medical School started and also the assistance for the residency, can be very proud of what we've accomplished. I think we've done really very, very well. I think it's a good return on investment. I think anything that the state does for education is a good return on investment. I'm particularly partial to this particular return on investment. Tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a product of this state's education from kindergarten to present day. Actually, I grew up in Mankato, Minnesota, went to public school, went to Mankato State, now Minnesota State College. University, rather, and then I went to Mayo Medical School, and now I'm back in Rochester practicing. So I appreciate what the state has done for me as well, so thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Adamson. I'm just trying to understand this. I think that in the 4 years I've chaired this division, this is the fifth year, I never have really understood this section of the budget. So it looks like we have two programs at Mayo that we provide subsidy to, the Mayo Medical School, and that says up to 42 eligible individuals, and the Mayo Family Residency up to 27. And so my question is, are these medical students, and they receive this amount yearly stipend, the program receives it to subsidize their education, and then with the residency, does that subsidize then the salary that the resident makes or the training that they receive? And are they just for Minnesota residents, or is it also for out-of-state residents?
Madam Chairwoman, I will speak to the medical school appropriation. We pass the allocation directly to the student in the form of a scholarship so that it helps them reduce the cost of their tuition. And it is specifically just for the Minnesota students at Mayo Medical School.
For us, and if I may, Madam Chairwoman, for us in the residency, it goes to cover part of the stipend that the resident gets. And it does apply to everybody in the residency.
So, and that is almost $20,000 a year for the residency.
That's correct.
Everyone,
Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling.
Just for the members' benefit, we're looking at page 12 of the higher education bill. It's section 6. It shows that the appropriation for the Mayo Clinic is recommended from the governor at $1.202 million for the first year of the biennium and $1.250 million for the second year. It's a $77,000 increase in the first year and a $101,000 increase in the second year. And as mentioned, those are divided then among the two different programs.
How much does a starting resident make for his stipend or her stipend?
It's around $40,000.
$40,000?
Yep.
Any questions from members of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Oddly enough, I have a question. I was just wondering about the tuition for the medical students with the buy-down from the Minnesota program. What do they end up paying an annual tuition about?
It will vary depending on the number of Minnesota students that we're able to apply. Typically, the allocation that we're able to give per student is between $10,000 and $12,000 per year. Our tuition this year will be $27,600. So they still, it's not quite half. It reduces tuition quite a bit, but not quite half.
This must be a maximum. Dean Porter, to your knowledge, has the state been providing this subsidy to the medical students at Mayo since the beginning of your program?
I would ask Senator Mr. Frank Iosi to answer that. I've only been at Mayo for 16 years, and I believe that it has been since the day we opened, but I'll defer to my colleague.
As a incentive to open the medical school. Welcome, Mr. Iosi. Is it professor? Is it doctor? Is it president?
I think lobbyist would be
lobbyist.
The best word.
Iosi.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Iosi. As alluded to, Mayo Medical School started in great part due to the request of the state of Minnesota in an attempt to provide more physicians to address the physician shortage in Minnesota. And it was a very difficult internal decision because it's a very expensive proposition, and the state doesn't get near to cover the cost of a medical education, which I believe was mentioned about $70,000. The capitation began with the first class as an incentive for Minnesota, for Mayo to start the medical school.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for the witnesses? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Madam Chair, may I comment?
Senator Senjum.
I'm perhaps personally a little too close to this to really truly articulate my passions, but I have had an opportunity personally to see this both of these schools work for a good number of years, and I will support totally the comments on one of those final slides that talk about the talk about investment and the value that the state of Minnesota receives on this particular investment. And it is huge, and as pointed out, a very goodly number of these graduates do stay in Minnesota, and I think this has gone a long way towards relieving physician shortages in this state. It's an important program, and I hope we can continue to support it.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. I was thinking about that myself, whereas the scholarships apply only to Minnesota residents, which seems appropriate for state scholarships. The stipends for the family practice residents can apply to everyone, but at the same time, they're providing services to Minnesotans throughout rural Minnesota. They're doctors that are providing services, and there's the whole point is there's a shortage of family practice doctors, and we need to attract them to the state, and we need their work as doctors. So I think that makes sense. Sarah Roebling, the next witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next we have Dr. Kathleen Mackin from the United Family Practice Residency Program here in St. Paul.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathleen Mackin, and I am a family medicine physician as well. I am the director of the United Family Medicine Residency Program in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it's in the West 7th Community neighborhood. I will mention just for information that I am the incredibly fortunate recipient of funding from the state, as I was in the second class at Mayo in the years when they did take many Minnesota residents. So I will just mention that. I really appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today to share an overview of the program, our program supported by the state of the Minnesota Bill SF0575, and in particular because the United Family Medicine Residency Program, which is an unaffiliated program, we're a standalone program, in particular because we received funding from the from SF0575 Higher Education in the last 2 years. One of the reasons I so appreciate this invitation is to thank the state and the Higher Education Committee for the support that we have received in the last 2 years. It is really, really, really appreciated, and I'm hopeful that I'll be able to share with you a little bit about our program in the next few minutes.
Dr. Mackin, I believe that United Family Residency was the only residency, family practice residency program that this committee was not supporting. So we did work on that for several years to get that support
right.
for you.
I believe that's correct also. We had been in existence, we've been in existence 15 years, and so it's this last, 2 years that we have received funding from this committee through higher education, and we're very appreciative of that. we are real proud of our convergence and the quality of our work. We train train family medicine residents, as you've already heard, who are in very high demand, and we train both for urban underserved and rural areas, again, as previously mentioned, to piggyback on Mayo's excellent presentation, people who would otherwise struggle for access. And you might wonder, how do we do the rural part since we're in St. Paul, Minnesota? 15 years ago when the program started, we were clear that the areas of need were substantially in urban underserved and rural, and we were, as United was at that time affiliated with Health One, there was rural sites that had tremendous need and were very vital family medicine clinics and practices, and we were able to partner with them in engaging in a two-month rotation throughout the second year for each of our residents. And that's proved to be a really valuable piece of our program. To share a little bit about the program, it started in 1993, and we, as contrasted, have 6 residents per year, so that's 18 residents total rather than 8 residents per year. And also, like Mayo, we've had very outstanding students all through the MATCH program, and also received a very high accreditation a level of accreditation from Graduate Medical Education Program. We're very community oriented, as I previously said, and also many similar things serve a lot of similar type patient populations to Mayo. Probably one thing that's a little bit unique about our clinic is that in the last 3 years, our clinic, United Family Practice Health Center, has become a federally qualified health center lookalike so that we have a sliding fee scale for patients regardless of ability to pay. And of course, we do full spectrum family medicine in such areas as preventive health, care of the medically complex patient, a lot of hospital work, nursing home care, home visits as well, homeless health care through Dorothy Day, care for new immigrants and refugees in particular at our core site on West 7th, as well as at Sibley Manor, where we have an extension of our clinic. We do high-risk teen OB both in our OB care in our clinic, but also teen care with face-to-face on the east side, and we have dental visits. Our visit numbers are 47,000 visits per year, and over 50% of our patients receive some kind of assistance in terms of receiving health care. As of this year, this summer, we will have graduated 71 individuals, and probably very interesting to you is that 74% of them work in the state of Minnesota, 32% practice in rural areas, and 19% practice in urban underserved. And we do have in the book that I think you received, or I think was passed out, a page that shows you the where they practice, to include War Road, Rogers, Princeton, Little Falls, Long Prairie.
Can you tell us the page number?
You know what? It's not paginated, but I'll. It's under UF. It's behind UFPRP graduates.
Okay.
Thank you. So we've been extremely satisfied that our residents have worked in the areas of need in Minnesota. I think one thing that also is helpful to look at in terms of areas of need is to go under the section that says FP needs, and this comes out of a national Office of Medical Service Research in Washington State through the Academy of Family Practice, and this is a pretty telling photo. Graph. This shows the red and the first of the pages shows the underserved areas in the state of Minnesota that do not have enough access. If you remove, and the pink are the partially underserved, if you remove family medicine physicians from those areas, the state looks like this, and this is the area that would be underserved without family medicine physicians. So it shows how critical the work, I think, of the residencies of the medical schools has been in terms of meeting the access of the citizens of the state. I think Senator Pappas, Chairwoman Pappas, you have already...
Which are the shortage areas? What color is the shortage areas?
The shortage area on the first page, which is with family medicine, is the red.
The red. Okay.
Right. And if you take family medicine out,
it becomes
like this. And this comes out of our national Robert Graham Center, Policy Studies in Family Medicine and Primary Care, which is located in Washington, D.C., and it's a 2003 file, so that's the most up-to-date file we have. Minnesota, if you're interested and can be very proud of this, has probably the best access of all 50 states in terms of access to primary care, is one of the strongest in the country. There's a smaller page that's included on the first of the pages under FP needs that shows the country and the red areas without family medicine.
What does HPSA stand for?
Health Provider Shortage Area.
Okay. Now it's starting to make sense.
Right.
Okay.
So the
white is not a shortage area.
Correct.
The pink is partial shortage, and the red is full shortage.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. That is correct, and there's a little key down here in case you wish to reference it in the future. Already mentioned by our chairwoman is that the program started without state funding. We really thought we should prove that we were able to do a successful job. So we've been privileged and honored to come and share with you the work that we have done. We're now funded by a combination of graduate medical education funds, the state med education research, which is Merck, state patient revenues and contributions from United Hospital, in addition to the funds that are appropriated from the state beginning in 2005. We are very proud and humbled and honored at the same time to have the opportunity to work with young and new docs to develop their expertise to serve and practice in Minnesota and elsewhere in underserved and rural areas. And I think
Dr. Mackin, are you seeing more women going into family practice medicine?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and if you look at the pictures of our residents, it's very obvious.
It's very obvious, right.
Right. In medical schools right now, I think the ratio is a pretty straight, like 52-48 or 50-50, very straight men-women. And in family medicine, I think, and I'll defer to our Minnesota chair in family medicine, Dr. Baird, who's with us today, it is also a pretty close 50-50. We happen to have more women in our program, and I may not be right about that.
And who is Dr. Baird? Do you want to raise your hand? Maybe you might want to come to the table after we... Well, come now.
Yeah.
Come now. Tell us a little bit about the state of family medicine in Minnesota. As soon as Dr. Mackin is done.
Well, okay. I think I just want to highlight again family medicine's place in the country. Now, this is a little bit dated information, but about 9 years ago, there were 830 million visits to office-based physicians in the United States. And of those, over 200 million were to family medicine physicians. So it's a very large percentage. And I think that really says, you know, what I would like to say, just that we feel that we are working diligently, responsibly, and passionately, as well as we love our work, to continue to train physicians for needed areas in the state of Minnesota, and to point out, too, that we're very intentional, as I think most family medicine programs are, to include issues with care of new immigrants, cultural sensitivity, cost effectiveness, high-risk OB, chemical dependency, and family violence issues as well. And again, I would like to thank the committee for your time and the opportunity to share a little bit about our program, and I stand ready for any questions. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
Thank you, Dr. Mackin. What's a starting salary for your residents?
It's 40, and it goes up to second and third year, maybe 42, 45.
I'm not seeing too many students of color, residents of color.
We actually interview and attempt to. We do not have many. We've had several people of East Indian heritage. We have had, but you can't tell from their photos, two people of American Indian heritage, an African-American person, and then just, I think, Chinese-American, and we have not had a lot of people of color, not because we wouldn't like to. It is not amongst medical students that we see who choose family medicine, we do not see those in our applicant pool.
At your committee.
And then there's the complication of the match, too, right?
Right. Although, yeah. But it really, truly is we just do not see them in our applicant pool. Okay. And that's the real issue for us.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I just wanted to point out that the appropriation in the bill is on page 4, subdivision 15. The recommendation is for $360,000 for each of the next 2 years of the biennium.
And that's the same as last year?
That's correct.
Dr. Beard, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Mm-hmm. Dr. Mackin has given a good summary, and so has Dr. Adamson, about the sort of history of family medicine in Minnesota. I presented on that last year, but I know some committee members are new. But I'll just introduce myself, and then perhaps both of us can answer questions as they come.
Okay.
My name is McCarron or Mac Baird. I also was trained at the University of Minnesota. I practiced in Wabasha, Minnesota for 5 years and then entered an academic career in various places, including 3 years at Mayo, where I was part of the family medicine department there. And they have, over the years, cared for my family members. And I grew up in Dodge Center, where one of their sites is. Now in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Minnesota, we sponsor 7 family medicine residencies with approximately 44 residents per year. Currently, I think we have 140-some residents in the total pool of residents we serve. I'll just touch base on a few things that I'm coming to today. One of them specifically is we became the sponsor for the St. Cloud Family Medicine Residency in July of this past year of 06. It was previously sponsored by our colleagues at Mayo. Their system evolved so that St. Cloud was not part of their practice development, and they called about a year ago and said, would the University of Minnesota like to become the academic sponsor of that institutional program well adapted to St. Cloud? We said yes. We went through the steps to become the academic sponsor. So one of the items in the bill mm-hmm. is to transfer those funds basically through the University of Minnesota to the St. Cloud program. So that's my primary purpose today, is okay. make sure that that's understood. It's not a new allocation. It's just transferring it from what previously went to Mayo with the support of the St. Cloud program to the University of Minnesota, also to end up at the St. Cloud program.
Senator Roebling, do you know where that is?
I do believe.
Oh, Subdivision 5, I believe.
On page 11.
There we go. It's $346,000 to support the residents in the St. Cloud Hospital. So okay. my understanding is that's not a new allocation. That's just a different place to put it. Similarly, still supporting the same family medicine residency.
Is this a special?
Yeah. That is under the state special, I believe.
Under special. Okay.
Now, also within that is the funding for the Rural Physician Associate Program, which continues. In fact, since last time when I was here, it's grown to 47 students last year after dwindling over the years to 30 students. So we're encouraged by that. This coming fall of 07-08 academic year, there'll be 44 students out. And it's a very productive program for producing rural clinicians of all kinds, but especially family physicians. Whether they go to any of these programs or not, they're well-qualified, sought-after candidates. And about 75% of them end up in Minnesota, and about 70% of them are in family medicine over the years. In fact, that single program has had about 1,200 graduates now since 1971 when it started. Our department has had similarly about 1,250 residency graduates. That's a different pool. Mm-hmm. And in each case, about in the residencies now, about 65% are in Minnesota. They're all in primary care. And about over the years, I think it's been now about 40% of our graduates from rural areas, and 5 out of our 7 programs are in the metro Twin City area. We also have large numbers of visits to the underserved. We have combined about 145,000 visits now, and we are in collaboration with Mayo Health System in Mankato for one of the programs, and then the other one is at the St. Cloud Hospital. The rest are in the metro area, serving populations of need all around the metro. So in summary, our department's program has been sort of multi-site. Mm-hmm. It's had significant funding from the state of Minnesota, as we've heard from others. All of these programs depend on multiple sources of income to maintain their teaching commitments. They teach not only residents and medical students, but other health professionals in each of these sites. Increasingly, we're involving pharmacists in the training sites, nurse practitioners, nurses, and other health professionals. In our department also, and I think Dr. Mackin's program also, we train mental health clinicians in these sites to work collaboratively. So we think that we have a good model. It's fragile because as the state funding for the underserved has faced some challenges, most of the patients are still seen. They're simply seen at no income to the clinicians doing it. And maintaining the salaries for both the staff and the clinicians doing the teaching for all of us from here to Casson has been a remaining challenge. But we're all very grateful for the state funding, which has helped populate, as Dr. Mackin showed you with the maps, clinicians in needed areas ever since its inception.
So, Dr. Baird, with has the legislature then in the past, through the health sciences special, supported family practice medicine at the U?
Yes.
And it's kind of rolled in, though, to the total amount. We don't have a separate line item for that.
We used to. We don't anymore. I think at the time of the cigarette tax changes, we lost the other separate funding, but we still have approximately the same amount of funding.
And how much is that?
I think it's $5.25 million, which now includes a subset of dollars going to St. Cloud. So it's been relatively
But that's
stable.
For also a bunch of other things. Do you know how much of that just goes to the family medicine?
It's around $5 million for a combined medical student education and residency education.
So you don't have it broken out in terms of how much for just the residents?
About $2 million goes to the combined residencies. I don't know the exact figure on top of my head. And about $3 million goes to the medical student teaching combined effort.
I don't think it's reimbursed.
What I'm trying to figure out is if there's some consistency across how we fund these programs.
Yes.
And it looks like we do. I mean, how I picked the amount for United Family Residency for the residents is it looked like we were doing about $20,000 per resident. So I'm just trying, maybe you could get back to me to let me know, is the money approximately subsidizing your residents at a rate of about $20,000 per resident, or is it less, or is it more? Or
I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Okay, thanks.
And I'll call or leave a message about that offline. My hunch is that it's about the same. It's been stable for years. A few years ago, there were significant cuts, but I think that was actually before Dr. Mackin's program was funded. And I believe we projected the funding at about the same level that we all had. So I would love to say that we would need a lot more money. I think, in fairness, I would say that it's been pretty stable for
it's
years.
It's been flat, pretty
and flat.
Senator Roebling, do you know why the governor has recommended a 15% increase for the two Mayo programs?
No, Madam Chair, I don't know. Right. I noticed the others are relatively flat, and there right. is an increase recommended for them.
Maybe Ms. Hegard knows. It was a Mayo request, but and people can request, but why do you do it?
Yeah. And Madam Chair, I'd like to Dr. clarify Beard. Also, the salaries for the residents are relatively the same all across the state. The year of the residency is mostly fixed to have us not bid against each other, and there's a fairness factor. So they're relatively the same across institutions. There may be some small variation, but it's not significant as far as the salary for residents.
Okay.
Benefits may vary slightly.
I might have missed this in your testimony. How many residents do you usually have in the program?
In the seven programs, we have a combined 44 residents now.
44?
Per year.
Family practice residents.
Family practice residents.
Is that combined with St. Cloud or no?
Yes, that's including St. Cloud. We have downsized one of the programs recently.
So it's 132.
So it's 132 residents total. And then some residents are off cycle, so some years there are around 140 residents who are still in the program because of illness, pregnancy, or other leaves. It floats a little bit about how many residents are in the program in a given point in time. But normally we have a...
So what's the difference? What's the difference? It's 44 each year?
44 each year times
okay.
three. So we have 3 years of training, just like all the other programs.
So
there are currently, actually, right now, there are 140 residents in the system that we're training.
The system means all the family practice residency programs?
All seven that are affiliated with
the University
of Minnesota that we supervise.
Okay.
There are separate ones in Dr. Mackin's program,
right.
Cassin, and Hennepin County.
Oh, Hennepin County has one, too?
Right.
Oh, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. That's a university program.
No, that's a Hennepin County separate program.
Oh, at the medical center?
Yes, at Hennepin County Medical Center. And then there is a 10-resident-per-year program in Duluth that is independently funded. And between now and a year from now, we at the University of Minnesota will become more connected to that program for a variety of reasons. They will become part of us more fully than they are now. But currently they're not within our budget.
Okay.
So that would push us, 10 residents per year, so we'd have another 30 residents combined. We'd have 160-some residents in the University of Minnesota pool by approximately a year from now.
Do you have this in a written format?
Yes.
Yeah, that would be really useful. Thanks. Right. Right, and that's per year. So. Okay, any questions for Dr. Mackin or Dr. Baird? Yes, Senator Sharon.
I'm somewhat familiar with this because there's a program that moved from Waseca to Mankato.
Correct.
And how many residents are in that program?
Up to six per year. I believe there are five per year now, and some years it's had four per year. So right now there are, I believe, 13 residents in the program.
Do you have difficulty recruiting? Thank you, Chair Babbs. Do you have difficulty recruiting to the rural settings?
We have had difficulty in the past. It's part of the reason that we actually asked our partner, Mayo, to help us build a new building and move it actually into Mankato, because one of the reasons we had difficulty recruiting was the travel time between Waseca and Mankato when they had hospitalized patients. And even though Waseca was somewhat more rural, in fact, than Mankato, which is sort of non-metropolitan but a sizable city, we moved it there about 2 years ago, and since then have had a much better time filling the program through the match.
One more question, Chair Pepp. My understanding of the program's, one of the goals, and you may have talked about this before I came, is that if they're training in the rural area, there may be an interest in staying in some of these areas where we're seeing lower numbers. And have you talked already about the outcomes that you have, that people actually engaged in these are moving into these more rural areas?
Yes, that's true. In fact, about 40% overall of our residents in the past 10 years of all the metro areas have gone rural. Mm-hmm. But in the rural programs, it's 75 and 80%. In Duluth, it's about 85% stay rural. In Mankato, it's about 80-plus percent. And St. Cloud is about 90% rural. The graduates stay rural in practice. And by the way, we have had both residents and faculty somewhat more of a underrepresented minority participation for a variety of reasons, probably because of our size and multiplicity of sites. But we have actually currently had a pipeline project with the African-American community in North Minneapolis with our Broadway or North Memorial Hospital program. We link to the high schools there, and we have one of our faculty members from North High and another one from nearby, two African-American faculty members there. We anticipate that can help draw people in. One of the medical students recently that joined the University of Minnesota medical class of this year was given a full scholarship. He's from North Minneapolis as well. So we're participating in a pipeline project, really, in North Minneapolis. The Duluth program has benefited from the Duluth Medical School, which is separate from the residency financially. But the medical school has a pipeline project with American Indian groups there and all over the country. And I believe we have 14 American Indian students in the medical school class at the University of Minnesota now, partly because of that, or primarily because of that pipeline. And they've had a number of American Indian graduates from the Duluth program. And frankly, we also know that the best way to predict a rural clinician in family medicine in Minnesota is if they enter the Duluth medical school class, 55 students chosen primarily for interest in primary and rural health care, so they have a selection criteria. Secondly, they go to RPAP, the Rural Physician Associate Program. They have about triple the probability of going to rural family medicine practice in their future career compared to anyone else. That's best in the country. So that particular pipeline is very productive for this purpose.
Dr. Madam Mackin. Chair, I would like to say, too, I think that's partly why the state has such a great, you know, much better access than many other states. The RPAP program in Minnesota really stands out amongst any other program in the country. And because it started in 71, I think people are committed to it regardless of the fiscal components of it, and it's been very effective for the state. We have many RPAP students that come into our program and go back to their small towns, either of origin or other small towns. So,
yeah, a final comment in that regard, then. You've been very patient with us, Senator Pappas. I'm a graduate of the RPAP program, ended up going back to Wabasha, and then I flunked RPAP and entered academics. But I'm still championing RPAP. It's now in the department and growing. And it's been recognized by the Carnegie Institute as one of the premier programs in the country for longitudinal education in medical school.
Great. And I see that Dr. Mackin has in her packet given us a list of all the family practice programs in the state. So
thank you.
That's helpful. Dr. Tomassoni. Senator Tomassoni.
either one of you doctors. So are we not having, I mean, the percentages are really high of how many are staying in rural Minnesota, but are they high enough to allay the problem of not getting enough doctors into rural Minnesota?
Well, it's not going well. Two years ago, we had an entire residency close, 12 residents per year that used to be produced, if you will, by the Regions program in St. Paul, closed entirely.
Right.
Our family medicine residency at Smiley's Clinic went from 12 residents per year to 6. We've lost, therefore, 16 spots per year. They're no longer going to be producing family medicine residents ad infinitum.
So that was a financial issue?
It was mostly financial, partly because the students were hard to recruit in both those programs. We've just built a new Smiley's Clinic. We're doing what we know how to do to him. I think it will improve the match.
Were all those students able to find a way to complete their residency?
Not all in Minnesota. They all could find a spot, but they went all over the country.
Yeah.
So we've lost about whatever. We've lost 16 spots out of 90. We used to have 90 approximately in Minnesota. So we lost about 20% of the production of family practice resident graduates in the state of Minnesota over the past 2.5 years.
So, Madam Chair, are those at 80% Duluth and 90% St. Cloud, and are they then not necessarily ending up in rural Minnesota? They could be ending up somewhere else? Is that what you're saying?
They could end up rural anywhere in the country, but they could also end up urban, suburban.
But you said 80% are ending up in rural Minnesota.
Yes.
Yeah, 90%.
That's right.
So we are getting all 80% of the doctors from UMD into rural Minnesota.
Yes,
or
indeed.
We aren't. Okay. And so is that percentage and are those numbers of doctors satisfying the need in rural Minnesota? They aren't.
No. In fact, just in Duluth alone, I've spent a lot of time there recently. We're recruiting a new dean there, and I've been chair of that search committee. And just one organization in Duluth wanted to hire 25 more family physicians by June. That's just one organization.
Okay.
In southern Minnesota, I've been told there's an appetite for another 40 between three different organizations with whom I've spoken.
Is it a better situation in the urban areas, or are there still shortages there too?
There are still shortages for all of our organizations. We're seeking positions we can't fill.
In the residency program?
No, in the faculty.
In the faculty. Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask if somehow we could use some of our state dollars as incentives to attract residents into the rural programs, or are there rules against us going like above the $40,000 annual stipend for the residents?
Dr. Beard.
Well, I used to be in Oklahoma as a residency director and then a department head in New York State, so I've had some experience with incentives. In Oklahoma, they have tried for many years to have loan forgiveness programs. And if you give it, my experience has been, and that's not making me an expert, just an experienced, sober person, the experience has been that if those incentives of loan forgiveness are given early in the trajectory of 7 or 10 years of training, people frequently buy their way out and go into highly paid specialties, and small communities that might have invested in them where the state ends up disappointed and the student feels bad but goes into highly paid specialty. So early incentives don't seem to work too well. In New York State, they paid programs through Medicaid funding, a 50% upweight in funding of the programs, not to support the resident salaries, but because when you're serving the underserved, as each one of these programs do, you're trying to draw people into lower paid salary careers in underfunded clinics, serving patients with overwhelming life problems before you get to their complicated medical problems. And some students seeking a career look at those circumstances and say, I think I'll do something else at a fairly high rate. So my estimate is nationally the rate of family medicine, if it weren't for other circumstances, would be filling at about 5%. This is Mac Baird's theory, because it takes an idealistic optimist to go into these fields. And at 5%, that's what you'd get. We're getting about 20% of the University of Minnesota graduates to go into family medicine, 15 to 20%. That means a lot of these incentives, frankly, have been working for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But we're competing with careers that have 2 and 3 and 4 times the salary range immediately out of residency, and then they go up. Mm-hmm. And they're working in clinics that are undercapitalized throughout the state if they're in primary care. So the Healthy Minnesota effort from the Minnesota Medical Association is focused on medical homes, the bulk of which are provided by primary care physicians, and the goal there would be to fund various things, including payment in their careers, upweighted if they provide a medical home for people, in order to make their career path more positive economically, and to help capitalize those clinics that are all around the state trying to serve these front-end care needs without MRI units in them that are overpaid and produce all the dollars. Mm-hmm. Editorial comment.
So after a family practice physician finishes their, it's a three-year residency program, then what typically would be their salary at that point?
Madam Chairwoman, their salary would be anywhere from about 125 to 140 to start, and it's relatively flat. It doesn't go up too much, around 160, 150 to 160. So there's not a great deal of growth there. And oftentimes the indebtedness out of University of Minnesota, which is the most expensive public medical school in the country, is between $150,000 and $200,000. So, and these are people with kids and, you know, partners, and, you know, they have, it takes them till 40 to 50 to pay their school loans.
So in reference to the first question, yes, there are loan forgiveness programs that can be developed. There are various incentives to produce sort of a higher rate of primary care physicians, not just family medicine physicians. But in fact, I think the most productive thing really would be to help pay better for the services they deliver once they enter the career. And there are a variety of barriers to that. The state has options in that regard, mostly around Medicaid payments, frankly. And if those, what we call E&M codes or management codes for chronic care were upweighted moderately, we could not only increase their salaries, I think that's less what they're concerned about. They have to pay staff from the front end of the back and upgrade the clinics, which are, can look pretty quickly sort of downtrodden. And if those are recapitalized, there could be a greater draw into these fields. It's not just incentive when you're a resident.
Do we have family practice physicians still working, like, for HMOs and other health providers? We do. And is that still the salary range for them as well?
Generally, Madam Chairwoman, and the salary range is, you know, starting that 125 to 140 in the 160. It can go higher. I mean, people, depending upon what they do and their practices and what areas, how much of their practice they have invested in, can go to the 200-220 range.
It's interesting. I'm just thinking back to our own family practice physician that took care of my children. He also belongs to my synagogue, and taking my daughters for play dates at his house. And it's a very modest house in South Minneapolis. And, you know, it's probably because he just finished paying off his school loans.
Well, remember, these people have to be idealistic optimists to go into this field, and you get a great bunch. They're not doing this because it's highly remunerative compared to other physicians. On the other hand, these are well-paid jobs compared to most people I know. And my parents were teachers, and you know, I think we all champion those people at those other ranges of salaries that do also very good work for our children and families.
So let me just, with the indulgence of the committee, let me just ask one more question. My daughter's dating a urology resident. Just starting his residency. So I think he has like 5 or 6 years of residency, so they're planning on being poor for quite a while.
Five.
Yeah. And then how much money will he make?
More than a family physician.
You know what? My daughter is a nurse, and she's in midwifery school, and her midwifery friends, you know, our friends who are midwives, have said she'll probably make less money than as a hospital nurse. Midwife. Just the way it works.
When I talk to medical students about this, which I do every day, we get into the same conversation. I say, now remember, you're trying to make sense out of the U.S. healthcare system.
Yeah.
This is a challenge.
Okay, very interesting. Any questions from anyone else? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we move on to, we're going to invite Ms. Hegard to join Senator Roebling now, and we'll be doing Article 1, 2, and 6 from the governor's bill. And while all the members are here, reminder from the staff is keep your copy of, which I didn't do, of 575 in your folder so you can make notes as we go along. And on Thursday, we're going to be covering Article 5, which is the private institution regulation and the OHE accountability report. And remember, on Friday, we have our NCSL workshop at the Humanities Center. And please let Catherine, who's here for a week, back with us. While Emily's on a long-planned family vacation, let her know whether you're going to be attending. And for members who have been appointed to the Regents Committee, we are going to meet next Tuesday evening on the 27th. And also remember that we have an evening hearing I think it's Rondo Education Center, and we'll be giving you directions. It's not very far from here. It's at, like, the university in Dale. And that'll be Wednesday the 28th, and that's a joint hearing with the House on with high school students about what their aspirations are for college, variety of issues. And then the St. Paul Public Schools is going to be doing a presentation on how they prepare their graduates for college. So we've got a lot of stuff we're doing. And welcome, Ms. Hegard and Mr. Kanis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just make sure that if you still wanted me to follow up on the question about why was there an increase for Mayo. I talked with Jane Rankin from the Department of Finance, and my understanding is that Mayo had requested some additional funding. There were other programs that did not. For example, St. Cloud did not. So our understanding is that the Mayo came forward, asked for the money, and that's why it was in the budget versus other programs.
Well, I think there's maybe some logic in trying to keep some consistency between what, you know, the amount of capitation per student.
That's a good goal, Madam Chair. I just wanted to draw your attention. We're handing out this slideshow. For those of you, we're not going to be going through this today, but for those of you who are not at our office for the presentation, we wanted to make sure that you had this available to you. But I'll be working off of the summary that Ms. Weidman prepared. And Mr. Mishkanis and I will basically be trading back and forth.
Yes. Could you come here and just chance a minute?
We're going to start with Article 1, correct?
Okay. And I'm going to
chair?
Chair for a few minutes.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, for record, I'm Mark Mishkanis with the Office of Higher Education. And I guess what I will do is step through the appropriations in Article 1 and point out where the recommendations may differ from the past and some of the new programs, obviously. And I'll start on page 2 with Section 3 of the Office of Higher Education. You see the total appropriation there in Subdivision 1. Subdivision 2 is appropriation for the ATEEV program, which I believe is in Article 3, which you're not dealing with today, but that is at a $46 million annual cost. One other thing to point out is that we're requesting some administrative fees on lines 28 and 29 of $250,000 the first year and $100,000 after that. The larger number in the first year is related to programming costs. This is a substantial program, so you need at least a full-time person to run the thing.
Mr. Mishkanis, would you reorient me again to where you were referring, where you were just referring
Chair,
to?
I'm looking at the bill. If I can read off the bill, if that's helpful for members, because there is language contained in the bill that I want to be able to point to, and some number changes as well. And I just spoke to lines 28 and 29 on page 2, which is the appropriations for operating costs for the ATEEV program. The next subdivision deals with the Minnesota GI Bill as a $15 million appropriation. Again, this is a separate article in the bill itself that I don't believe you're taking up today. I'm going to get back to next week. But again, just to point out that there is some money for administrative fees in there, a bit less, $152,000 the first year and $104,000 ongoing. Again, this is a significant program. This would pay for some programming costs, FTE, and other operating-related costs. Subdivision 4 deals with the state grant program. The current base for the state grant program is about $145 million a year. This is an increased request of roughly $5.5 to $6 million each year. It's a little bit higher in the second year. And this encompasses three parameter changes in the state grant program. The first one is an increase in the tuition and fee maximums of $400 for both the four-year programs and two-year programs. For the four-year program, it would go from $9,438 to $9,838. And then for the two-year programs, it would go from the current level of $6,436 to $6,836. There's also an increase in the living and miscellaneous expense allowance of $200 that's in the rider contained. In that subdivision. And there's one other parameter change that's embedded in the appropriation request change, Madam Chair and members, and that is actually that is a statutory change that I can come back to later on when we come to that point to describe that.
Madam Chair, I have a
Senator
question.
Senator
Coyne. Mr. Canis. I don't know if this would be the appropriate time for this question. I was just wondering about the Minnesota GI Bill. We just heard this in the Ag and Veterans Affairs Committee, there was an amendment put on at that point, and I'm wondering if that is reflective of, I'm seeing a no, okay, of what, and I'm wondering, are we going to add how much that, because I think it's going to substantially bring the cost of up.
If I might, Madam Chair and Senator Coring, we were there the day in the Senate when that when that amendment was put onto the bill, and as we expressed, I think, at our testimony, we're concerned about the fiscal impact of that amendment. We want to make sure that there's coverage, and we think there are concerns about the amendment as it was put onto the bill. So we're doing some runs at our office, working with the Department of Finance to try to really gauge the impact of that amendment on the bill. My understanding is that the bill would come next to this committee and that they were relying on this committee to figure out the fiscal impact.
Right.
Senator Erickson Ropes is the author of that bill, and I suggested to her that she talk to Ms. Rankin, and you might want to also check with her because I think she just has some information and perspectives she wants to be considered.
So we're working on that then.
Yeah, because the fiscal note, sometimes fiscal notes assume that everybody is going to use the benefit, and maybe that's not the most realistic number. And I don't know if that's what you're going to do or not, but some people may already have college. They may not use the benefit. They may leave the state.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. And if it's an open and standing appropriation, we have to have all the money set aside, but maybe there's a way we can kind of cap it or something.
And Madam Chair, I just would say that, you know, and I guess what we're deciding in the last committee, in the Ag and Veterans Affairs Committee, is if it was good policy. And of course, I think we all agree that it was good policy, but the question is, you know, can we pay for it? You know, I think it'd be nice if we could have college be free for everybody, but is that realistic? And so I'm just concerned that, you know, I'm certainly all for veterans, ultimately, somebody has to pay for it, and I'm wondering if there's enough money to pay for it.
Well, my understanding is this benefit is the kind of the last dollar. So
it is,
first the federal GI Bill, the Pell Grant, the state grant, all that has to be considered and before this
and
kicks in.
Madam Chair is correct on that. Yep.
Madam Chair,
okay, Mr.
Mishkanis. Just to that
sure.
point, though, we
Senator Sencha.
Madam Chair, may
on
I
this
raise
issue
a,
on this point.
Not on the
Let's
GI
Mr.
Bill, but on the state grants.
Let's let Mr. Mishkanis finish
okay.
then on the GI Bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Senator Corian, just to let you know that the cost is going to increase substantially. And we are taking, of course, all the things into account that you've mentioned, Madam Chair, about who uses it, and it's the last dollar. We've been working on this thing since last summer.
Okay. Senator Sengen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Is it Mystic?
We should have the pronunciation on the schedule.
Mr.
Cannes. Okay.
Mystery
Cannes. Okay. You said it.
On the state grant program,
and I'm just, you know, because we hear so much about tuition, I just want to make sure I kind of understand this. And you know, we have a state grant program, and it seems to say that. Yeah, if the appropriation in either year is insufficient, then the appropriation for the other year is available for it, whatever that really means. But then we get into these numbers about seemingly tuition maximums. And is that suggesting that that would then be the tuition maximum? For instance, a private institution tuition maximum is $3,800 and some. is that for the University of Minnesota? Or we talk about the private institution as well. And so I'm sitting here confused. Are we talking about St. Wolf College? Or are we talking about the University of Minnesota? And so I'm way out. I'm not catching on to this thing at all.
State Financial Grant 101. This is complicated, yeah. Senator Central.
Madam Chair, Senator Central, I believe you're going to have a little more discussion about financial aid next week. So.
Oh, okay.
We'll get into the details.
Can you do the 30-second explanation,
yeah,
and
just
we'll get into it later.
I don't need a lot, but just...
There is a limitation on what's recognized for tuition and fees at institutions across the state. It's not open-ended. This cap does tend to affect the private schools, both the profit and for-profit. But what's occurring now, and, of course, in 2008-2009, the University of Minnesota will be bumping up against the cap, which is one of the reasons we're recommending increasing it by the $400.
Okay.
It's the two-year institutions at Minsky that are not there on the two-year side so much, nor the four-year state universities.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll probably need to go to that class.
Senator Hegard is it'll just be during our regular committee time.
Okay.
Senator Hegard, having a hard week. Ms. Hegard, is there a recommendation here for a continuation of the LME adjustment as a way of dealing with surpluses?
Madam Chair, my understanding is no, there is not a recommendation in this bill.
Is the office going to have an alternative recommendation, then, to some other way to deal with it instead of the LME adjustment?
No, not at this point in time. We had some concern had been expressed by the Department of Finance. I think they'd expressed it publicly in hearings before you about kind of setting a precedent of doing that. If it's done in higher ed, could it be done in other areas of state spending? So I think it's worth a conversation with them and with us. But at this point in time, that proposal is not part of our bill.
So with this appropriation amount, how much more is this than current law?
Chair, members, it's, I think, roughly $5.6 million the first year and $6.1 the second year.
5.7, did you say?
5.6 million.
5.6?
5.6,
5.7.
6.1. This is above the current base appropriation.
So, Madam Chair, what we're doing is we're capturing some of the existing surplus for these new proposals, and then we're proposing some additional new state funding for these proposals.
Okay.
Madam Chair, we've supplied Mr. Albrecht with a memo that details all the changes underlying this program. And if committee members would so like, we can certainly supply that to them as well.
Okay.
I'll move on, Madam Chair.
Yeah, please go on.
Subdivision 5 is the Safety Officer Survivors Appropriation. In the past, this number has been buried in the state grant appropriation, and we thought it would be just clearer and easier to track if we separated. This is not new. The reciprocity appropriation of $2 million, we're actually asking for a $1 million year increase over the current base level. We started to have to pay North Dakota.
This is North Dakota.
So this would be to cover that payment.
So that means more Minnesota students are going to North Dakota than North Dakota students are coming to Minnesota? Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's right.
And the agreement with North Dakota is we pay the higher of the two tuitions?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Latz?
I should say we raise tuition here, and that's part of the consequence.
So they're going to North Dakota. Mm-hmm. They pay Minnesota tuition, though.
They're paying, so either way they're paying?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Madam
Never
Chair.
Mind.
Senator Horobling.
Another factor could be that the University of Minnesota is getting many more applicants than they can accept, and North Dakota's population is dropping. And so they may have more open slots there, actually, and more students can get admitted.
And maybe the entrance requirements are stiff. I don't know. Who knows?
Madam Chair, I think there are a number of factors. The entrance requirements might be different, and the schools are different.
The schools are different. There are different
fields, right, on both sides of the border.
Okay, continue.
Madam Chair, then subdivisions 7 through 14 is a list of various programs, state work study, child care grants, mini techs. For the most part, these are at base level funding. I'll just point out the ones that where there's a difference. The Learning Network is an increase of $575,000 a year. This is off a base of about $4.2 million. And that would be in the list. The other ones are base level funding, Madam Chair. I would point out that because I think you serve on that commission, Madam Chair, the Midwest Higher Education Compact, the fee that they're asking is actually above the $90,000. It went to $95,000, but it was so small an amount we didn't ask for a change request.
We're going to, Madam Chair, take that out of our own budget, $5,000 at least this time. We're willing to do that. We're able to do that.
But again, Madam Chair, the rest of those are at base level funding, so I'm not sure if you need to or desire to talk about those at all. Subdivision.
Did we ever, after 4 years ago, did we cut the state work study and the child care grants, and did we ever bring them back up, or is that still the same level they were after the cuts? Anybody remember that? We didn't cut it?
Madam Chair, those programs, my understanding from staff is I don't think those programs were cut when the reductions occurred. We didn't cause a reduction of state grant programs. Is that right?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, there was a year in which we transferred most of the money from those two programs to meet a shortfall in the state grant program, but the base level of funding was not cut. It went back to the same level the subsequent year.
Okay. Great.
Madam Chair, then Subdivision 15 is the United Family Medicine Residency Program, which you just heard about.
Could you just talk a little bit, though, about 413 through 422nd, 422? You kind of skipped over that. Other small programs.
These are the other small
programs.
Just remind
us.
There are four of them. Madam Chair, those would be, the budget includes about $115,000 each year for post-secondary service learning, $125,000 for student and parent information, $184,000 each year for the Get Ready program and outreach. That's the state matching money. And then $496,000 for the ICAP program.
Madam Chair?
Oh, we put an extra $1 million in that. Senator Michelle.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. When you're finished on this particular paragraph, I wanted to touch on something else.
Didn't we put more ICAP money in 2 years ago?
Yes, Madam Chair. And that's included in this number.
Oh, so maybe it went from 500,000 to a million or something. Okay. All right. Now are you ready for your question?
I am.
Okay.
If you're done.
I'm done. Senator
you,
Michelle.
Madam Chair. Mr. M.
That's a good one.
That works. Line 410, you have a line item for the Minnesota College Savings Plan. What's that for? And are there other pieces of this bill that impact the College Savings Plan?
Madam Chair, well,
let me
just mention a technical point first. The amount in the bill is incorrect by $100,000 a year. The base number is $1,020,000. That has been more than sufficient for the match for the college savings plan the past couple of years. We're actually spending about $350,000 annually as a base level, I guess, for that program, that match program. And that's two parts. There is a match up to $80,000, I believe, 15% of up to $50,000 of income of the matched amount, or 5% between $50,000 and $80,000 of the matched amount. There are some other internal changes in the bill that would seek to raise those matched amounts so that more of the appropriation would be spent.
Okay, thank you,
Michelle.
Madam Chair. And so this is the match that is income sensitive. Is it $200 or $500? Is that what I remember?
$300 is a cap.
Okay, it's capped at $300. And we do not have any. Some other states make contributions to this plan deductible. We do not do that, correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Michelle, we do not at this point in time have a deduction for college savings plan. We're one of, 11 or so states that don't have a tax deduction for the savings plan. But we do have something other states don't have, which is a match for lower-income, middle-income families.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
There's more detail in Article 2, Section 2032 that we'll be getting to later that talks about those changes, raising that amount from $300 to $400, and then the percentage of contributions matched for families in the 50,000 to 80,000 income category. I think we heard testimony on one of our site visits that it was 5%, and the proposal is to raise that to 10%.
Thank you.
And they think they can do that all within the current budget because the current budget has not been used up by the people who are accessing it right now.
What about child care grants? What are we hearing about the kind of the unmet need there?
Madam Chair, you referred earlier to the LME and the use of the LME to spend surplus funds in the state grant program. We actually made two changes to LME the last 6 or 7 months to accomplish that provision in law. There is another provision in law that allows us to transfer money between programs. And since there was about a little more than $3 million left in the state grant program and in another program, we didn't think it wise to go out and try an LME change. It really doesn't go that far. Mm-hmm. We did actually transfer some funds to the state grant, to the child care program, and we did take care of what is the current waiting list. Mm-hmm. I think the amount transferred was about $400,000. So we've been able to take care of it, but only on a short-term basis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we can skip over United Family Medicine.
Madam Chair, the subdivision 16 is the agency's administration. This is at a base level, except that it does reflect the governor's 2% recommendation on compensation as a salary supplement of $39,000 the first year and $80,000 the second year.
Okay.
Madam Chair, subdivisions 17, 18, 19, and 19 are a language that's been in the bills in the past that allow us to transfer money between biennials and certain programs. They don't cancel. And transfer between programs, as I just mentioned with the child care program. There is one change on the transfers. Because of the recommended change in the college savings plan, we've added that as a program that funds could be transferred to in case we're simply wrong on the response of people and we're short. But the subdivision 19 reporting functions are similar to what's been in past bills.
But you weren't able in the past to transfer the unused money from the college savings plan into other programs?
I'm sure we could transfer from it, but we couldn't transfer to it.
Oh, so now you can do both.
Now we can do both.
So the money you've had that you haven't used in the college savings plan in the past, what have you done with that?
I'm sure it would have canceled back to the general fund.
Oh, so you weren't able to transfer it before.
Well, Madam Chair, we could transfer from it. Because of the projections and the surpluses in the state grant program the last couple of years, there's been no need to transfer to that program.
Right, but I meant it to other programs. You weren't allowed to transfer. So now we're putting that in here so you can transfer either way.
This would be either way, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I mean, if finance isn't going to let us do the LME adjustment, we need to find other mechanisms for flexibility so we can continue to be using the appropriated money for the students.
Madam Chair, I do want to just make this minor correction on the reporting on subdivision 19. We're actually asking for authority. This would be on page 6 of the bill in paragraph B, that we could match a couple data sets we have and then do a report to the relevant committees in the legislature looking at participation rates by income and persistence graduation rates of state grant recipients and those that do not receive a state grant. We have the data in-house. In the past, we've been precluded from doing this on the advice of the Attorney General's office because of data privacy issues. And this would authorize us to do that match.
Not 15. Let me just move it somewhere else. Okay, sorry. So continue.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if you could advise us on how you want
to
do it.
Okay, I guess you have to repeat that since I wasn't listening. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, we have two data sets, an enrollment data set and the state grant data set in our offices. And these are individual data items. And we've been advised by the AG's office that we can't pair those data sets up.
Oh.
Data privacy issues in the past. And this has been advisory, but we've taken their advice. What we're doing is seeking some authority from the legislature to do that match in order to report on issues like persistence rates, participation rates, graduation rates by income, so and whether you're a state grant recipient or not. Our intent is to be quite careful with the match, essentially create a third database that's only pieces of both the other two. But we think that's an important question to ask, and since we already have the information in-house.
Are you running this separately through the Data Privacy Committee?
Madam Chair, no.
We're not asking for data privacy
language.
We're not changing data. I think there's some concerns of the AG's office, but we didn't think it rose to the level of changing the data privacy laws.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
I think with some of our accountability measures that we're hoping to look at, that this would be very useful information. And I think they're telling us that they believe they can do this without identifying individual students.
Okay.
And if that's the case, we should be pretty safe doing it. But I guess we'll have to that may have to be determined if that can be done without identifying individuals.
Is that all in Article 1? We have more in Article 1.
Madam Chair, that's all for the office in Article 1. Of course, it includes the appropriations for Minsky and the university. And if you want to advise us on how you want to deal with those.
I think we're going to go on to Article 2 then.
Madam Chair, I'm asking Ms. Grimes to join us because she's going to be helpful, I think, on some of the language changes that we're putting forward, beginning with Section 1.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Section 1 is a repeal of a portion of language on the mandated report on tuition reciprocity. This was language that went in on the House side last year. In that particular case, they wanted us to track information on individual students, but the report we actually did track was provided summary information on students, and everybody seemed to think that that was adequate, so we're going to repeal the language that would have required us to track individual students and reciprocity students and where they end up locating afterwards. Much different sort of scope of the project.
Madam Chair, let me discuss sections 2, 3, and 4, and then simply allude to a number of repealers that are related to these sections. You saw these sections last year, actually. This came out of the report that was required under the 05 bill relating to the enrollment adjustment for the higher education systems. We reported on the findings of that task force to you last year and the recommendations that came out of it, and they are in the formula language that you see in front of you.
Do you still need to have that language then on 14.5, 6, and 7?
Madam Chair, this actually, we try to clarify the reporting aspect and our authority so that the new language there would give us the authority to actually ask for some more information from the system. But we have this data advisory group where we bring everybody in to talk through why we need data, what it's going to be useful for, and what it's going to be used for, and also useful.
So it's an ongoing consultation?
Yes, yes. Madam Chair, I know that the environment is perhaps different about the funding policy than it was a year ago and the 67% as far as the relationship to instructional costs. What I'd like to do is maybe just read to you the particular recommendation from this task force on that current law. The task force recommends that the funding policy statement in Section 105A be repealed, but that a new statement be developed that more clearly addresses the needs and missions of both systems. It's clear from the data, which is in that report, that the funding policy of covering 67% of instructional costs is not being met, and this discrepancy is so large that it's unlikely in the current budget environment that the goal will be met in the foreseeable future. But secondly, and this was an important aspect from the University of Minnesota, not Minsky so much, the perspective of the University of Minnesota, the policy does not address two significant parts of its mission, research and public outreach. So the idea wasn't just simply do away with the 67%. It was to find a replacement for it, which was not part of the recommendation, but to be more inclusive with the University of Minnesota and then have a conversation about what the 67% actually means. And again, as I said, I know that there's a different environment this year than there was last year about this, but there's a number of recommendations on the language that simply clean things up as well.
Madam Chairman, Section 5 is one of a number of things that I'll mention as we go along. It just updates a reference to a renumbered statute. And Section 6, 7, and 8 make similar kinds of technical changes. So let's skip to Section 9. This is another piece of the language on the report on tuition reciprocity that makes it clear that the agency will be reporting summary statistics rather than statistics that track individual students. On Section 10 is language about eligible institutions in terms of the state grant program. It states that starting in fiscal year 2012, institutions would have to be participating in the federal Pell Grant program in order to be eligible to participate in the state grant program. It's a little bit similar to a proposal we made last year that did not end up getting enacted. And it means that some of the small institutions that currently participate in the state grant program but not in the Pell Grant program would have 4 years to begin participating in the federal Pell Grant program. Our goal is to make sure that the institutions have some fiscal stability and that the students are getting the Pell Grants that they're eligible to.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
This is also the provision whereas you can't qualify for the Pell Grant for the first 2 years of startup, right? So it would mean that any new startup institution in the state would not be eligible for the state grant until it was eligible for the Pell Grant, and that would be after 2 years of full operation. And we did have some discussion about that last year.
It's been an ongoing issue. Mm-hmm. Making sure we have stable educational opportunities that are fiscally responsible, but also not wanting to inhibit the growth of new educational opportunities. So. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could deal with Section 11 then. This was the third piece of the change in the state grant appropriation. Within the state grant obligations, if you will, for paying for college or post-secondary institution educational services are assigned to three parties, the student, the family, and the taxpayer. The assignment to the family is based on federal needs analysis, and there is an assessment rate structure much like an income tax structure in the needs analysis. However, it is extremely progressive. Over a very an income range that you wouldn't think this would apply to, between around 30 to 65,000 of adjusted gross income, the top marginal tax rate, if you think about it in those terms, is 47%, which is much higher than anything at the federal or state level on the income tax side. We think that it's too progressive, and the change that we're recommending here would tend to mitigate that somewhat by 5 percentage points for both dependent and independent students. We already do this for independent students, so this would increase that reduction by 5 percentage points, and again, as for dependent students as well. So,
and you're also, I didn't realize that this was in the current law, but you're also continuing to provide some consideration for independent students who aren't getting any parental contribution.
Right. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
If this is one of those things, if I had my choice, it would be higher than it is even being proposed, or lower than it is being proposed, but it does cost the state grant program additional money, so we have to probably do it in increments.
Well, you don't want to encourage or incentivize parents to not help their kids, but there are so many situations where they don't. You know, maybe they can't, but usually they don't.
Right. And Madam Chair, we're looking at very moderate income families here, even with the change.
I think this. Madam Chair, one of the things that I wanted to note about the changes that we've put on the table is we tried to look at the students who would benefit. The income, the tuition cap piece, students at the private institutions, and then students at the U would benefit from that primarily. The LME, all students would benefit from that. And this particular change that we're proposing for the adjustment income, that would really benefit lower, middle-lower income students between like $25,000 and $60,000, providing them with a deeper grant. It's one of the few changes we've done that gets inside of the program. Many of these changes are sort of on top of the formula, but this actually goes in and changes the an internal piece inside the program.
Okay. Madam Chair, I do want to point out there is a technical change in this section as well, some clarifying changes that Mr. Albrecht actually brought to our attention. So.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Section 12 speaks to the treatment of incarcerated students in the state grant program. When an incarcerated student applies for a state grant, the agency subtracts the Pell Grant the student would have received if the student were not incarcerated. When we started doing this, incarcerated students were eligible for federal Pell Grants. Since then, the federal government came along and made incarcerated students ineligible for federal Pell Grants, but we have continued to subtract the Pell Grant as if they were eligible. The effect of this is that very few incarcerated students receive state grants. There is language elsewhere in the statute that says that incarcerated students do not receive a living and miscellaneous expense allowance since their living expenses are already being paid for by the public. But this speaks particularly to the tuition and required fees portion. The proposed language would give the agency clear authority to continue what we currently do, and the result of what we currently do is that very few incarcerated students receive state grants.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling,
because of the ban that they have for the use of the internet in prisons, there really are very few opportunities for incarcerated individuals to attend college. Largely because they can't leave the facilities very frequently. Very few of them are eligible for leaving, and then they can't use the internet. Because of problems that we've had in other areas, and so it doesn't. There aren't many eligible for the grant, but there aren't many.
But really, isn't it a good idea for them to use their time while they're in prison, taking college courses? If it's going to help them get a job after they graduate, yeah, shouldn't that be something that we should try to facilitate rather than put up barriers? And Senator Roebling, I understand that more and more colleges are going to the use of the internet, but I've taught independent study classes where students had, it was not an internet course. Students could submit their papers, they could send them by email to me as an attachment, or they could send them to me in the mail. And that's the way I had several students from Stillwater, and that's what they did, is they sent me their papers. It was mostly writing and reading. That's what independent study classes usually are. We don't meet in person, and they would just send them to me in the mail. And sometimes, there are barriers from the institution as well. They wouldn't mail them out on time, whatever. But they were able to take college courses by doing that. In fact, I even arranged for they had to interview their legislator, and one inmate had come from Senator Dill's district. We have to ask him about this. And so I arranged a time, because they couldn't meet in person, that the inmate had to go to a phone, so he had to, arrange for a phone through his counselor. I think he arranged for a phone and called Senator Dill. But when I was setting it up, Senator Dill said to me, well, what'd he do? And I said, well, I didn't ask him. You ask him. So after they did the interview, I said to Senator Dill, well, did you ask him what he did? He went, no. So it is possible to do that.
Madam Chair, one thing, we just wanted to be clear in our proposal. We're just asking for statutory authority to do something that we're doing now.
Right.
There's a concern. We don't want to be doing things if we don't have authority to do them. So we just wanted to ask.
I understand. I'm just questioning about whether that's the appropriate policy.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tom Soni.
Madam Chair, you said very few prisoners get financial aid. Is there a profile of the ones that do get financial aid that you can kind of lay on us here so we understand who gets it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, we'd have to get back to you on that. I don't happen to know that.
because they don't have living in miscellaneous expense. So it's just the tuition, the books, and they're assuming that they get the Pell Grant, which they don't. So then there probably isn't a lot of state grant. And they're probably only taking one course, which is, what, $600, $700?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni.
It's Grimes.
Most incarcerated students would have either zero income or very nearly zero income, and so they would be eligible for a maximum state grant. Uh-huh. And so by the time they're also rather unlikely to enroll for full-time course load.
Right.
And so by the time you subtract a $4,000 maximum Pell Grant from their required tuition and fees, there's very likely little any tuition and fee money left that the state grant would cover.
Right. So we would have to say that the Pell Grant is not considered because they're not eligible for it. And I don't know that we do that. I mean, is there any program? I mean, there are students who don't qualify for the Pell Grant that get state grants.
Yeah, Madam Chair, are. Senator Pappas, that's correct. This actually was brought to our attention by Mr. Fuller, and if it were the legislature's intent that more incarcerated students got state grants, we would need clear language that we could. If the legislature wants us to keep doing what we're doing, we need clear language that would allow us to do that.
Okay. Well, you know, if members should just let me know what you think is a good policy here. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I think your policy is a good policy.
To make them eligible for the state grant?
I think they should
even
be eligible.
Not discounting the Pell Grant.
Whatever the barriers are, if they're able to surmount them and get into a college course and want to take it, I think it's to the public's benefit for them to be able to take that course.
If that was the case, do you think that if they took one course, say, per semester, would the state grant that they'd be eligible for, just off the top of your head, cover the full cost of the class?
Madam Chair, I'd
say they had
to
no income.
Have time to look into that if we could, please. We do, that you can get a state grant for taking as little as 3 credits. Mm-hmm. However, it is not a lot of students who take less than 11 credits actually end up receiving a state grant. So I would like a little time to investigate that, please.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm thinking there isn't much, but there is some money, I think, in the Department of Corrections for educational programs within their institutions. I know that the Shakopee Women's Prison has an ongoing educational program, and I don't know that the individual inmates pay individually for that.
It's not college classes, though. And I think we had a presentation a couple years ago from somebody who was starting a nonprofit to raise money to pay for prison, for classes, college classes for prisoners. Does anybody remember that? Maya, do you remember?
Madam Chair?
Yes,
Madam Chair,
Ms. Grimes?
Our office happens to be housed in the same building with the Department of Corrections, and it's the Minnesota Correctional Educational Foundation that is raising money.
Are they still
going about doing that. I don't know a lot about exactly how much activity they have going on in terms of providing additional courses, but I know they are fundraising for it.
Well, why don't we check into that and see where they're at right now? Because they were just starting out last time we heard from them.
Right.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Section 13 is a technical change that clarifies that post-secondary child care grant recipients who are called up to active duty are considered continuing students when they return for purposes of priority in getting child care grants. Section 14 is a technical change suggested by the reviser. Section 15 is also language on eligible institutions. This one would apply to institutions that participate in the self-loan program, again saying that that starting in fiscal year 2012, they would have to be participating in the federal Pell Grant program. Sections 16 through 21 are technical changes due to renumbering.
Madam Chair, let me discuss section 22. Actually, this is language you saw last year. It would authorize us to enter into a financial investment method called interest rate swaps.
Is this going to reduce your costs somehow doing this?
What's the advantage? It would help us manage risks
better.
And actually, and our sense is to help us to maximize our return. This is related to the self-loan program. And at times, we have anywhere from $30 million at a minimum to $145 million that we're investing. Of course, we're limited by state law on investments. Housing Finance currently has this authority. I can't tell you whether they've used it or not, and I believe PCA does as well. The language you see in front of you mirrors their authorizing language. Our sense is to take very small steps to understand how this works, and if it makes sense, we would pursue it, but never to get too far into the pool, if you will.
So obviously finance is willing to let you do this.
I'm sure they're familiar with this language, yeah.
Madam Chair, sections 23 to 26 are technical changes due to renumbering. Section 27 is a technical change in state work study that would make a few more students eligible for state work study funds. It doesn't have a fiscal impact because each campus would still have to work within its allotment of state work study funds.
Section 28 through 31, that refers to the Intervention for College Attendance Program, the ICAP grant program. Mm-hmm. We haven't asked for additional revenue in our bill here, but one of the things that we thought would make sense is to include just in the definition retention. There are exemplary programs that we're recognizing that get students ready for college, but there are also some programs in college that are very, 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 very successful in terms of keeping students in. The same students that have faced challenges trying to get into college often are the same ones facing challenges staying in college and finishing on time. So we'd like to expand the definition just to include the word retention programs.
I think we might have discussed this when we were at the agency's office, but in terms of the ICAP grants, how much were you, maybe how many grantees, requesters, grant requesters were you not able to fund, and about how much money was that?
Well, we were able to fund, I think, 17, or was it 17 or so programs? 17 or so
14,
programs?
I think.
14 programs. We have a report that we've put together, Senator. If you'd like a copy of that, we can get you the copy.
Does it include how many people applied and
the applicants as well as the grants
and how much you weren't able to fund?
Yes, correct.
I don't know your sense of this. I mean, Minsky asked for $24 million to serve the underserved. I think the governor recommended $12 million, and it's the same, similar to what the ICAP program is, where we've got like $1 million. That's quite a bit different. And so, what's your interpretation of that? Is because Minsky has what 52, 53 campuses? They're going to spread that money over all the campuses. Those campuses could apply to you as well as community-based organizations and high schools for grant money, but they haven't. I mean, I'll ask Minsky the same question as to what's the difference here?
Madam Chair, our program is small, but we do fund, it's a competitive grant program with a match required, and we do have Minsky applicants, we have private college applicants, community organizations. We're very open to, you know, whoever wants to apply. I happen to think that there's some value in having a consistent focus. I think it's appropriate for Minsky to be focusing on at-risk students. They have many open admission institutions, and that's a critical population for them to focus upon. But I do wonder, though, if you've got separate programs at the U and then separate programs at Minsky and separate programs at the private colleges, is there any way to have a good look across all of it to make sure that mm-hmm. there's some consistency and what? How do we know whether they're
so we have kind of a best
made.
Practice
yeah,
model.
You know, so if there's something that we can do to be more helpful, certainly there could be room to grow in our program. There wasn't a new revenue proposed in this particular bill by the governor, but it certainly is scalable if that's something that someone was interested in. But I think our interest was at least in getting this one word injected into the definition to allow for some if there were a couple programs that came to the door that looked like they were exemplary and would do a good job in terms of retaining students, we'd like to fund those as well.
Yes. Yeah, it would be nice to get a kind of a whole picture of what the ICAP grants do, what the TRIO programs are doing, what other, non-TRIO college-based programs are doing, what the university is doing.
Madam Chair, I think MMEP, the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, has tried to take a look at that through some of their efforts. Our agency is taking a look as well, and I know the Department of Education is too, trying to get a handle on how many college access programs there are and to what extent are they successful.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Section 32 contains the changes that we discussed earlier with Senator Michelle on the college saving plan that would increase the maximums and the percent against the of credit for the families, $50,000 to $80,000.
Okay. Any questions on Article 2?
Madam Chair, there are a few other repealers that
the repealers.
I want to
All
talk
right.
about. We did talk about the ones related to the funding report, but there are a few other ones.
Madam Chair, all of the repealers that say 135A are related to the funding report that Mr. Misiukanis described. And then 136A.07 repeals the mandate for report to the governor and the legislature. This is a holdover from when it was the Higher Education Services Office and we had a council that was making recommendations to the governor and the legislature. It also is a holdover from the days before the Internet. It used to be the vehicle we used to provide enrollment statistics to the legislature and a number of other reporting on what we do. Now we continuously update those things on the Internet as the information becomes available. And so we have not actually provided this information in recent years, except through the Internet. We have not done a specific report to the governor and legislature. So that language would repeal that. 136A.08, subdivision 8, is repeals a portion of that language on the tuition reciprocity report. And 136A.1702 repeals a 1987 piece of language that required that the agency go to the Legislative Advisory Commission before selling bonds in the SELF program. And that's a long time ago now. Seemed like time to let that piece of
language
go.
Okay. Anything else on Article 2 for now?
Madam Chair, Article 6 is very short.
All right.
Yes.
We are under time. That's great.
Madam Chair, the other thing that I understand you had on your agenda was Article 6.
Article 6 is the prevention of fraudulent college degrees, and this would name a new statute making it a misdemeanor for individuals to knowingly use false or fraudulent academic credentials to obtain employment, promotion, or professional occupational licensure. The purpose is to deter individuals from purchasing fake degrees, et cetera, from degree mills. So often there are folks that want to go after the schools, and these fly-by-night schools, these diploma mills, they're basically like a laptop plugged into a wall, and they can move with ease, and it's very, very difficult to pin them down. The feds have had trouble as well. So what we thought we'd try here is to focus on the individual fraudulently, knowingly using the degree in an inappropriate manner, and it would be a gross misdemeanor. Is that correct?
Just a misdemeanor.
Just a misdemeanor? Just a misdemeanor. Yeah, that's right.
Madam Chair, I did submit this same bill as a standalone bill, or the same article as a standalone bill, because we're concerned that it will have to go through the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
So I'm in contact with Senator Foley's office to see how he wants to handle it, because we were trying not to send our whole higher ed bill there. But if they approve it, we can roll it back into here, we're thinking.
I think it might be Senator Moore's office, though. Because she is judiciary. Senator Foley has a funding division.
Oh, okay.
So
wrong
let me check
division,
with her.
Then. I better talk to Senator Moore's office.
You know, because it's not a gross misdemeanor, they may not need to see it, but it's kind of up to them.
Okay.
That's a good idea, though. That's a very good plan. Okay, any questions on Article 6? More comments? Okay, then I think we're done for the day. Thank you all very much, and we'll Senator Senjum, you had a question.
I don't think specific to this group, but at some point, going back in our document to page 6, and I think that's Article 1. Right?
Yeah, it's Article 1.
Would there be a chance to ask some questions about Section 4 there, and there's 5 or 6, perhaps maybe not. Maybe 3 or 4 under general appropriations where I'm not sure this panel is equipped to deal with those questions. But I mean, what are the? I mean,
the Minsky section.
Yeah, the Minsky section.
Well, we had 2 days with Minsky in front of us, and then I think at that time the office presented the governor's recommendation. So you might have to ask those questions.
I'll ask those offline.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, there was just one thing I wanted to mention, that our report on accountability, we released that today. It looks like this, and there's lots of data and information. It's available on our website if you would like to take a look at it or download it, and we'll make it available to members. We'll also be doing a mailing shortly.
Well, you're going to be here on Thursday talking about it.
That's right.
And we'll be talking about it, but I wanted to let people know if they wanted to see it, it's available
ahead of time.
Today.
Right. I think.
Homework.
Homework, right. Okay. No other business to come before the division, then we're adjourned.